Sit in meditation and think of all the countless sentient beings there are in the universe, countless, inconceivable number, and recall that they've all been kind to us in this life and in previous lives. Recall that they want to be happy and not suffer as intensely as we do. And that there is no good reason why we are more important than them. There are many bad reasons, but there's no good reason. Recall too that when you live among other people who are happy, then you yourself are happy. And when you live among other people who are miserable, then you yourself are miserable. And so if we want to be happy ourselves, it makes sense to care for the happiness of others and not to inflict pain and conflict on them. Recall too that as long as we and others are in cyclic existence, there's never, never going to be complete happiness. And so for that reason, it's imperative that we practice the path and get out of cyclic existence, and that we attain full Buddhahood, so we'll have the capacity to lead others from the burning house of samsara as well. And so with that kind of motivation, then let's listen to the teachings this evening. So I think it's quite important for us to remember that there's many bad reasons why we're more important than others, but there's no good reason. Yeah. Many bad reasons, aren't there? Like, I'm me. That's about the only reason we can come up with why we're more important than anybody else, is because I'm me. Can you come up with any other reasons?
And I'm great.
I'm me and I'm great. I'm better than them.
What other reasons do I need?
Yeah. 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 I'm me and I'm better than them.
Why didn't say that, but yeah.
So, therefore, I should have the first pick of happiness and others can come along and get the remains. That's a good reason? It stinks, doesn't it? It's a horrible reason. And yet that's the reason that we say to ourselves every day when we go about trying to get our way. Yeah? And being unhappy when we don't. And letting others know we're unhappy when we aren't. Don't. And yet the reason is, you know, totally stupid. And also it's counterproductive, you know, because when we go about, you know, making other people miserable because they aren't giving us our way, then they're miserable, then we live with a bunch of unhappy people. And moreover, because we've made them miserable, they're not going to like us very much. And then we wonder why we feel lonely. Yeah? I mean, it's all the function of the self-centered thought. And so that's why, you know, the Shantideva and the Buddha all told us this is the big enemy. Yeah? So we're not bad people because we're selfish. Get rid of that guilt trip of I'm such a bad person because I'm selfish. Because that guilt trip only keeps you stuck in being self-centered. Yeah, so get rid of it. And just see that the self-centered thought is really the one, you know, one of the ones that makes us miserable. And we're tired of being miserable. Aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay, so we have to really remember it and remember that the source of the misery is the self-centered thought. It is not other sentient beings. Yeah, I mean, we can blame other sentient beings. We can blame the external situation. Yeah, but what's it going to get us? Nothing.
Problems.
More problems. I mean, we've been in cyclic existence since beginningless time using that strategy to get happiness, and it hasn't worked. Yeah? So it's time to try a different strategy. Okay? So that goes for our daily life with people, and it goes for our motivation for listening to teachings, too. Not just about me. Okay? Yes? So, let's continue where we left off. We're on 395. Since a thing does not exist, a non-thing cannot exist. Without a thing's existence, how can a non-thing be established? Okay? So a thing is something that is produced, that's impermanent, that's a product of causes and conditions. A non-thing is something that's permanent. Okay? So what this verse is talking about is, since there's not truly existent things, there aren't truly existent permanent things either. Yeah, so since there aren't truly existent functioning things that are changing, there can't be truly existent permanent things that are unchanging. Why? Because permanent things all depend on impermanent things. Okay? Permanent things basically are negations. They're the absence of something, you know, or the opposite of something, or the isolate of something, okay? So they're mostly negations. In fact, I can't think of something that's not. So to have a negation, you have to have the positive thing that is being negated, okay? So if there's no positive thing, which are functioning things that are impermanent, that are truly existent, then you can't have truly existent permanent things either. Okay? And even if we talked about disintegrated things, yeah, you couldn't have disintegrated things without having the thing there that had disintegrated. Okay? So we couldn't have past phenomena without the present phenomena. If the present ones don't truly exist, then the past, yeah, they're having disintegrated, yeah, or even the disintegrated phenomena, either of those, you know, couldn't exist because they're all positive in relationship to functioning things. So if there's no functioning things that are truly existent, there's no permanent things that are truly existent either. Okay, 396. If things are not empty because they are empty by virtue of reasons, the thesis would not be distinct from the reasons, and thus the reasons would not exist. Okay, so it's not as hard as it sounds. So we're going to be talking the next couple of verses about refuting that things are not empty. In other words, that people are saying that they inherently exist, because analogies and reasons to establish emptiness exist. Okay? So it's showing the absurd consequences from asserting that there is true existence because there are reasons. Okay, so when we prove emptiness, we give a reason. Yeah. So somebody's saying that reason is truly existent. Yeah. So this chapter, they're trying to find something. They're grasping at straws, you know. So we negate emptiness, you know, by whatever reason we use, and that reason is truly existent. So therefore, true existence exists and emptiness doesn't exist. Yeah. Okay. So Joe Blow is saying here, to prove emptiness, you have to put forth reasons. Since the reasons exist, they aren't empty. Okay? Because what's Joe Blow's problem here? What's he thinking? What's he confusing? Right, so he's confusing existence with true existence and saying the reasons exist, therefore they must truly exist. Okay, so that's a wrong assumption on his part. Okay, so they say that the reason proving emptiness or proving anything is an inherently existent reason. And if so, then we have to ask, is that reason one with the thesis, or is it inherently different from the thesis? So we're using the analysis. Is the reason inherently one with the thesis, or is the reason inherently different from the thesis? Okay? So if the thesis, okay, and the reason were inherently distinct, yeah, then, like, if you had the thing, you know, the person does not inherently exist because it's dependent arising. So if dependent arising and not inherently exist are inherently distinct and separate, then there's no way the reason could prove emptiness, because things that are unrelated and separate have no relationship. On the other hand, if the reason, dependent arising, and the thesis, the predicate here, you know, emptiness, if they're inherently one, then they're totally identical, in which case, again, the reason couldn't prove the thesis. Because if they're one, you know, they have to be separate for one to prove the other, but if they're inherently separate, then they're unrelated, and that the reason can't prove the thesis. Okay? Okay, so the reason and the thesis aren't inherently one, they aren't inherently different. Then, verse 397, the first one was, if they aren't empty because of the presence of reasons. This one, in 397, is if they aren't empty because there's analogies for emptiness. Because whenever you make a reason, a reasoning statement, you use an analogy. So it says if things are not empty because there are analogies for emptiness, can one say, just like the crow, so too the self is black? Okay, so this is showing that, that the absurd consequence of asserting that things are not empty because there's analogies for emptiness. So the previous verse was they're not empty because there's reasons for emptiness. Here it's because there's analogies, okay? So since there are analogies for emptiness, like the reflection in the mirror, the dream, the echo, the magical illusion, the hologram, all those kinds of things. So Joe Blow's saying, since there are analogies for emptiness, like the reflection in the mirror, everything exists and isn't empty, just like those analogies, because those analogies truly exist. So here he is again, dear Joe Blow, thinking that if it exists, it must inherently exist. Okay? So remember, for the lower schools, they use the reason of dependent arising to prove an inherent existence, whereas the Madhyamaka use it to prove emptiness. So the same reason is used to prove opposite things. Yeah? But their reasoning is incorrect, because dependent arising doesn't prove inherent existence, because inherent existence doesn't exist. Okay, so so again, we're in the same thing, that if the analogy, like the reflection in the mirror, if that inherently exists, yeah, then is it inherently one with the thesis or inherently different from the thesis? And again, we have the same problem. If it's totally different from the thesis, it can't be an analysis, an analogy that helps you to understand the thesis. Yeah. If the analogy is completely, the same as the thesis, then again, it can't be used as an analogy to prove it, because it is that thing. Okay? So again, that same difficulty, same problem. So what we keep coming back to is, if it's inherently existent, it must be either inherently one or inherently separate. And that's something that's quite important to understand in the four-point analysis. It's the second point. And very often we don't put much attention on that second point, because we're too focused on the first one, which is identifying the object of negation. But it actually is important, to understand why, if something is inherently existent, yeah, it's got to be either one with, let's say, the basis of designation, or totally unrelated to it. Or if it's the reason why, it's got to be one with the thesis or totally unrelated to it. Okay, we've got to understand that. Because with respect to inherent existence, that means something has its own nature that's independent of other things. Okay, if something has its own nature that's independent of other things, then it's like, then that means it doesn't depend on anything, that nothing can affect it. Yeah, nothing can affect it because it has its own nature and it's sitting there. So nothing can affect it. Yeah. And similarly, it can't affect anything else. Because if you aren't produced by causes, you can't produce an effect. Okay? So then, if something, is there in and of itself, then if we analyze how does it relate to, let's say, its basis of designation, yeah, then it's got to be one or different, because everything is either one or different. But in the context of being inherently one, Yeah, it doesn't just mean one nature. It means totally identical. And in the context of being different, it doesn't mean just being different or different natures. It means being totally unrelated. Okay? Because something that is inherently existent can't be one nature with anything, because that's a dependent relationship. And this is something that's independent, that exists on its own. Okay? So we have to keep coming back to that. Otherwise, we just kind of generate lip service. Yeah, it's got to be inherently one, or it's got to be inherently different. But if somebody says, why? And or if somebody says, why can a conventionally existent, dependent, arising thing, why doesn't that have to be inherently one or inherently different? Why do only inherently existent things have to be inherently one or inherently existent? We have to be able to answer that question. Yeah? Why with a conventional thing? Yeah? When you analyze a conventional thing and you find that it's not one with its basis of designation and it's not separate from its designation, why is that okay? Yeah, because you know it's dependent. Yeah. But a conventional thing, is it different from its basis of designation? Yes, it's different from its basis of designation. Is it a different nature than its basis of designation?
No.
Okay. Is it one with its basis of designation?
No.
Is it one nature with its basis of designation?
Yes.
Yes.
Why? Because they occur together.
Yeah. They occur together. Okay. 398. If things exist inherently, what good is it to perceive emptiness? Perception by way of conception binds. This is refuted here. So this verse is about explaining the purpose of teaching emptiness. So Joe Blow again says, if analogies and reasons and all other things don't exist, what's the purpose of writing this treatise? So what's his mistake here? Yeah, if they don't exist truly, they don't exist at all. So he says, analogies, reasons, everything else doesn't exist. So why in the world did you write this thesis? Yeah?
All these verses.
Yeah. Like you could have saved yourself the hassle. Okay. So Aryadeva responds, for the attainment of liberation and omniscience through understanding the meaning of suchness. That's why I wrote this thesis. Okay? Because if things existed inherently, what good would it be to perceive emptiness, since emptiness would be erroneous? Yeah? So what he's saying to Joe Blow is saying, why did you write this? Because nothing exists. Or Joe Blow saying, why did you write this to prove emptiness, because everything inherently exists? And Aryadeva's coming back and saying, if it inherently existed, then I wouldn't need to write this treatise. Because if it inherently existed, we would be perceiving ultimate truth with our eyes. Yeah? Our eyes would be valid cognizers of the ultimate mode of existence. If that were true, we're in bad shape. Yeah? Because then there's no way to get rid of attachment and anger and jealousy and ignorance and everything else. Okay, because we would already have the wisdom understanding the ultimate nature. And wouldn't that be ridiculous to have the wisdom understanding the ultimate nature and still be suffering in samsara? And that's totally nonsensical. Okay? So, yeah, if things existed inherently, we wouldn't need to perceive emptiness, because emptiness would be wrong, and then I wouldn't have written this thesis, okay? But believing an inherent existence causes us to wander in samsara, while understanding that all phenomena are empty brings liberation. Yeah. As long as we have conceptions clinging to true existence, we will be bound in samsara. Okay. Therefore, in this treatise, a truly existent person and truly existent aggregates, which are the objects, the referent objects of the grasping of true existence, are refuted by extensive reasonings. So he's refuting the conceived object of the grasping at true existence by using many, many reasonings. And that's what the last eight of the 16 chapters have been about. Then there's a sutra quotation that says all phenomena are empty in that they do not exist inherently. So this treatise is for that reason. It's written to teach the lack of true existence. Yeah. And that lack of true existence does not contradict our system's acceptance of dependent arising. In other words, things can lack true existence and still arise dependently. In fact, if they were truly existent, they couldn't arise dependently, because truly existent things don't depend on anything else. They have their own nature, their own entity, they're independent. Okay, 399. To say one exists and the other does not is neither reality nor the conventional. Therefore, it cannot be said that this exists and that does not. Okay, so this is showing that conceptions of the extremes of existence are erroneous. So this is a refutation of the Citta Mantra, and it points to the question that you've been asking. Okay? So Citta Mantras and others who haven't understood the meaning of the scriptures talking about the ultimate nature. Whoops. Okay. It's when you think that the microphone and the clip are inherently one. And then they aren't. Okay, so these schools that, especially Citta Mantra, who haven't understood the meaning of the scriptures that talk about emptiness, say that consciousness is truly existent and external objects don't exist conventionally. So this is incorrect because, in fact, both are the same in existing conventionally, but not ultimately. Okay, so to say that the consciousness exists truly and that external objects don't exist at all isn't accurate because, you know, neither of them exist ultimately and neither of them are ultimate truths. Okay, so the consciousness, yeah, they say the consciousness exists truly. It doesn't exist truly. Yeah, why? Because it's dependent. It arises due to causes and conditions. It's dependent, on the mental factors that occur simultaneously, mutually dependent, you know, on them. Okay? And then external things, you can't say that they're non-existent. Yeah, again, because according to the Prasangikas, they do exist. Yeah. So neither the mind nor external things are ultimate truths, because ultimate truths are the final nature of being, the how things actually exist. Yeah. So neither of them are ultimate truths, and a truly existent consciousness and the lack of external objects, also that's not conventionally true either. So when you look at the other systems, yeah, they all assert ultimate truth and conventional truth, but none of them have the correct definition of ultimate truth and the correct definition or idea of conventional truth. So it's not like they have the ultimate truth, okay, but they're wrong about the conventional one. Yeah. Yeah. But they're wrong on both accounts. Okay. So, so that presentation isn't a presentation of the ultimate, and it's not a presentation of the conventional, because both of them exist, both the consciousness and external objects exist conventionally and are conventional truths. All five aggregates exist conventionally, they're conventional truths. None of them exist ultimately. So it can't be said that the consciousness and the mental factors are ultimately existent. Okay, which is what Chittamatra says they are. Okay, so the Madhyamakas accept both external objects and consciousness as they are known in the world, which means that they exist just by worldly convention. That's all. Okay. Verse 400 of the 400. Against one who holds no thesis that exists, non-exist, or do not exist, so those three options, or none of the above, counter-arguments cannot be raised no matter how long one tries. Okay, so this is the impossibility of refuting through reasoning that which is free from the extremes. What are the two extremes? Nihilism and absolutism. Okay, so when assertions regarding true existence have been thoroughly refuted in this way, it's impossible to refute assertions regarding emptiness. Okay, so when all their assertions, why things are truly existent, because reasons exist, because analogies exist, because products exist, because of all these different reasons, because I see it, therefore it exists, all these different reasons, when you've refuted all those reasons, yeah, then there's impossible to refute the assertion of the emptiness of true existence. So Job Lowe's last final comment is, even though we can't answer you at present, you will receive an answer. And Aryadeva's response is, that is a futile hope, Job Lowe. If we held a faulty thesis, it could be refuted by proving its opposite, like you've been trying to do, okay? And you would be able to prove inherent existence, yeah? But no Madhyamakas hold erroneous theses that things inherently exist or are totally non-existent, or that things, non-existent things, are inherently both existent and non-existent, or neither, yeah, Madhyamakas don't hold any of those wrong views. So no matter how hard you try, you can't put forth any counter-argument that is going to negate what we're asserting. Okay, so refuting the proponents of emptiness is as impossible as drawing pictures in space or causing space pain by beating it with an iron bar. Okay. And then Gyaltsev Jay's summarizing statement. The sun's light dispels all darkness. Darkness has no power to destroy the sun's light. The correct view destroys all extreme conceptions, banishing any opportunity for controversy. Okay? And then there's a colophon I thought I would read. Okay. So it says, this concludes the treatise of 400 stanzas on the yogic deeds of bodhisattvas from the mouth of Aryadeva, the spiritual child of the exalted Naga's feet. Mm-hmm. At the exalted Naga's feet, the spiritual child of Nagarjuna. He was born miraculously from the heart of a lotus on the island of Sinhala in Sri Lanka. Having crossed the ocean of our own and others' tenets himself, he made the middle way most clear by distinguishing between correct and incorrect views. It was translated and the meaning settled in the temple of Ratnagupta Vihara in the center of the glorious Kashmiri city of Anupamapura by the Indian abbot Supsa Manjana and the Tibetan translator Batsab Nima Drak. Okay? So the Tibetans, whenever they translated works from Sanskrit or from whatever language into Tibetan, they always had an Indian who spoke Sanskrit and a Tibetan so that they could make sure somebody understood the Sanskrit very well and somebody understood the Tibetan very well so that they could make sure that the meaning was getting translated correctly. And then Gyaltsev Jay has a verse here. And may the one predicted, which means Nagarjuna, the one predicted by the conqueror, who attained the supreme state, as well as Aryadeva and the glorious Chandrakirti, because we were following Chandrakirti's commentary here too, who most clearly elucidated Nagarjuna's good system, rest victoriously on the crowns of our heads. Unable to bear misinterpretations of this system, through the misconceptions of those who follow their own presuppositions, who lack the flawless eye of reasoning and ignore the textual systems of the great trailblazers. I have explained the words and meaning of this text simply, commenting in a clear, unconfused, and complete way on the paths that mature the mind and bring about release for all people with a Mahayana disposition. Since Aryadeva's thought is hard to ascertain, and my mind is poor, my acquired knowledge weak, may my spiritual guides and deities forgive whatever errors there may be. Through any immaculate virtue created by my efforts to illuminate the good Madhyamaka path free from extremes, may all transmigrators bound in the prison of worldly existence attain the peerless happiness of liberation. May I too in all future lives never be separated from a spiritual guide of the Supreme Vehicle, and through fully entering this path by listening, thinking, and meditating, may I obtain the state of an omniscient conqueror. So I want to read those last three verses that Gyaltsev Jay said, because this is exactly how I feel too. Okay? So since Aryadeva's thought is hard to ascertain, as is Chandrakirti's and Gyaltsev Jay's, and my mind is poor, my acquired knowledge weak, may my spiritual guides, especially His Holiness Dalai Lama and Geshe Nawang Darge, who both taught me this text, forgive whatever errors there may be. Through any immaculate virtue created by my efforts to illuminate the good Madhyamaka free, good Yamanaka path free from extremes, may all transmigrators bound in the prison of worldly existence attain the peerless happiness of liberation. May I too in all future lives never be separated from a spiritual guide of the Supreme Vehicle, and through fully entering this path by listening, thinking, and meditating, may I obtain the state of an omniscient conqueror. And then to go back to his first verse here, may the one predicted by the conqueror who attained the supreme state, as well as Aryadeva and the glorious Chandrakirti, who most clearly elucidated Nagarjuna's good system, rest victoriously on the crowns of our heads. And then it's always a custom to start at the beginning again. So I'll just read from I'll read the explanation of the title that Gelsenche gives, and then a few verses from the start of the text. So in Sanskrit, ka-sata-ka-kasa-shra-kari-ka-nama, that's the title. In Tibetan, senchu-shi-gyape-she-jebe-siklur-chepa, the treatise called the 400 Stanzas. And then the first verses here. If those whose Lord is death himself, ruler of the three worlds without a master, sleep soundly like true vanquishers, what could be more improper? Those who were born only to die and whose nature is to be driven appear to be in the act of dying and not in the act of living. You see the past as brief, yet see the future differently. To think both are equal or unequal is clearly like a cry of fear. Sickness can be cured and aging treated, therefore you do not fear them. Yet there is no cure for the last ordeal. Thus, obviously, you fear it. Like cattle intended for slaughter, death is common to all. Moreover, when you see others die, why do you not fear the Lord of Death? If because the time is uncertain you think you are eternal, one day the Lord of Death will do you injury. That's the beginning of the text. And it's a good reminder at the end of the text, too, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So, questions? This is, she said, the 100th, exactly 100th talk. Of my talks, or including the review sessions. Okay.
In the first verse, you say that the permanent thing as a non thing depends on the functional impermanent things.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit more?
Okay. Well, it's like Jeffrey when he was talking on Tuesday about empty space. The empty space is the lack of obstruction. So obstruction is a functioning thing. It's a positive phenomena. Okay? Space is defined in terms of that obstruction because it's the lack of that obstruction. Okay? So, you know, as a lack of something, as a negative, and the negatives are all permanent, yeah, then, you know, you have to have something that's being negated. and that something is usually, but not always, an impermanent thing.
So this logic applies only to space?
No, no. For example, emptiness, yeah, is also permanent. It's a negation. Emptiness isn't posited dependent on a functioning thing. It's posited in dependence on what's non-existent, which is inherent existence. But again, it's a negation. Or if we said, it's another permanent thing, the opposite of being an elephant. Okay? So, to know the opposite of being an elephant, yeah, the whole category would be permanent. Then that's would be defined in terms of elephant. It's negating elephant.
Why would the opposite of elephant permanent?
Okay, because, well, let's just say non-elephant. Non-elephant means everything that is not elephant. Okay, we're negating elephant. So everything that's not elephant. So among the things that aren't elephant, there's some impermanent things like the computer, but there's many, many permanent things as well. Okay. So, or like true cessation. True cessation is the there's different ways of defining it. One way of defining it is the absence of ignorance, anger, and attachment in such a way that they can never arise again. So ignorance, anger, and attachment exist. They're functioning things. True cessation is the absence of those, you know, not just a regular absence, but the absence in such a way that they can no longer arise.
I just realized that in all these examples you give, the permanent thing is a negation.
Right.
Of the functional thing.
Yes.
Got it.
Okay.
Uh-huh. There are no permanent things that are negations,
either. I can't think of anything. I mean, yeah, they all, in one way or another, wind up being negating something, even if you say the isolate of something. Yeah, the isolate is, yeah, well, anyway, it's hard to define. But anyway, yeah, yeah, they all seem to be involved in negation in one way. Because the thing is, if something were a positive phenomena, yeah, then it would function. Yeah, and functioning things are dependent on causes and conditions.
Meaning
generality is also permanent.
Yes, and negates everything that isn't. Is that right? That's what it means.
Yeah. Everything that, yeah, that isn't that. And it puts together a lot of things, diverse things. Okay. So we finished it. So we have to thank Nagarjuna for teaching Aryadeva and Chandrakirti for commenting on it and Gelsub Jay who followed Jay Rinpoche and commented on both of those and Geshe Nawandarge and His Holiness. And may anything I said that was incorrect, may you totally forget it. May the video go blank and beep at that spot. And, you know, all the errors be evaporated into, may they be as existent as inherent existence.
Golden ground, oh, Maja Pensa, on the iron fence around the edge.
In the center is Mount Meru, the king of mountains. In the east, the continent Videha. In the south, Jambudvipa. In the west, Godanaya. In the north, Guru. In the east are the continents Deya and Videya. In the south, Kamara and Apara Kamara. In the west, Ratra and Uttara Matrina. In the north, Kurava and Karava. Here are the bushes, winter, winter, tree, bush, fulfilling fell about harvest. Here are the precious wheel, precious jewel, precious queen, precious minister, precious elephant, precious birds, precious general, great treasure base. Here are the gods of beauty, goddess of song, goddess of song, goddess of dance, goddess of flowers, goddess of incense, goddess of light, goddess of perfume. Here are the sun, moon, precious parasol, and victory banner. In the center are the marvelous riches of gods and humans, with nothing missing, pure and delightful. I offer you as a bitter field to my glorious holy finding, Guru,
particular to the Master of the entire doctrine, the noble spiritual dimension, and an offering to thank you for your kindness because we have received the profound Mahayana teachings.
Please accept these with compassion for the sake of migrating beings. Having accepted them, please bestow on me and on the mother sentient beings abiding as far as the limits of space your inspiration with loving compassion.
This round
anointed with perfume, flowers strewn Mount Meru, four lands, sun and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offer to you. May all beings enjoy this pure land.
Iram Guru Vatna Mandala Kamiryataya.
Spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Buddha, Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all things.
sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzing Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
Hear the supreme spiritual being, omniscient king of the Shakyas, Mother Vitara, supreme bestower of longevity and wisdom, vast ocean assembly of sources of refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to both. With a clear mind and extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Dutin, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples of the Light Children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in the glory of eternal bliss.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Floor.